This program is sponsored by Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts. Located in 185 Worcester Street, right on Route 9, they can be reached at 508-545-8105 or at wickedchronicvendorcommerce.com. Wicked Chronic is a boutique-style retail shop that focuses on selling counterculture products such as Wiccan, cannabis cultures coming together in a unique setting. You need something for that special spell? Go on down to Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts and speak to Beverly. Tell them Dr. Chris sent you. Check them out today.
Friday the 13th, the series, a crime committed 3 decades ago.
Killing them won't get rid of the anger that's inside of you.
And a father's stubborn, vicious hatred passes on to his oldest son.
No!
Now, a race against time to prevent it from happening again.
Ray! How can you help Daddy? He's dead!
Not where I'm going, he ain't.
Time travel back to a frightening future on an all-new Friday the 13th, the series.
This is the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to all the canceled TV series in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror genre. I am your host, Dr. Chris. Whoa, hold on, what is playing? Okay. Now do your intro.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
In tonight's episode, we continue our coverage of Friday the 13th, the series, with episodes 7 and 8. Mr. Seneca has the episode synopsis for us for episode 7.
Hate on your dial. Originally aired November 6, 1989, a racist uses a cursed antique car radio to travel back to 1954 and tries to prevent the arrest and death of his father, a member of the KKK.
Or the episode that Jack and Johnny go back in time and nearly get killed fighting the KKK and socially
yes.
relevant crap in this episode to today. Holy
shit. Oh, my
shit.
God. So much.
Oh, boy. And I thought the Nazi episode, and I got called out that a few times on one of the groups or whatever, saying, how is this relevant? And I was just like, well, because of, you know, the alt-right. Now, this episode with a young black kid being gunned down in the streets in the South by a white dude with a gun?
Yeah.
Gee, that's not socially relevant whatsoever. Holy crap. This episode was, like, intense to watch. That was even before they did the time travel episode. I mean, sorry, that was before... Let me rephrase that. Pause. Hold on. That was before they time-traveled back to the one of the worst eras in Southern history.
Oh, my God. And this takes place in Mississippi, of all places. The entire episode is really focused around one date, and that's May 17th, 1954, what is known as Black Monday to the racist circles.
We're not going to say what circles they are in that are racist. Just to get this out of the way, is Mississippi today still heavily racist?
Yes.
Okay, all right. So it is. Okay.
I can say that with absolute certainty because the actual segregation for Mississippi schools, even though the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which came out on May 17th, 1954, Mississippi refused to desegregate or offered only minor token segregation until February 1970.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's still a lot of people there that live there and still harbor these hatreds towards black people.
Now, this episode
or really anyone different.
This episode was directed by Alan Eastman, who actually is from Canada. The amount of racism in Canada, someone told me, is very low. It exists, because racism exists in almost every country. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that it doesn't. But the amount of racism in Canada is not as bad as it is in the United States.
I couldn't believe that.
I've got
a lot of family members in Canada, and I do notice a little bit of a difference in their attitudes.
Yeah, I've had several Canadian friends tell me that what we perceive to be racism is shocking in Canada because they have not eliminated it in a way. There is still, unfortunately, it does exist, but it's not as... You're not hearing about the reports of what's happening in Canada like you are in the United States almost on a monthly basis.
Yeah, you're not. You don't really hear about cops that will shoot an unarmed black kid for just playing with a toy gun.
Correct.
You know, you're not going to hear any of that. The Canadian police system is completely different in their interactions with everyone around them.
Alan Eastman also directed several episodes of Andromeda, which was the show starring the Hercules actor.
Kevin Sorbo.
Kevin Sorbo, who unfortunately is a huge Donald Trump supporter.
Aww.
Yeah. But he also directed Stargate Voyager, Stargate DS9, Star Trek Voyager, Star Trek DS9, and Stargate SG-1. I need to make that very clear. FX the Series, Tech War, Sliders, Poltergeist, Nightman, Beastmaster, Degrassi. Do we see a theme here with a lot of the shows he's directed? They're all heavily geek-centric and all, like, not public domain. What's the name of what syndicated-type TV series?
Mm-hmm.
My favorite is Nightman, which I would love to cover one day. It's based on a Malibu comic book, which is currently owned by Marvel Comics that I don't do anything with.
Is that the one that has the bandana or something that he wears and the long cloak?
He doesn't wear a bandana, but he does wear sock kind of face. He has like a Batman face thing, but his hair is exposed.
Oh.
He's got like one red eye, and he can defy gravity with the suit that he wears. He's like a jazz singer.
Okay.
He uses like holograms of himself to play jazz music while he's running around fighting crime. I guess you think about these like good-looking, long-haired, muscle-bound jazz singers that women are throwing themselves at, or you're thinking nobody's like taking their panties off and throwing it on the stage, and it just passes right through the hologram. Because that never happens to musicians, right? People aren't throwing their underwear on stage at them, right?
For musicians?
Yeah.
I guess it just depends on the musician.
Several of the actors in this episode, I wonder how uncomfortable they were having to play some of these type of parts. But we have Archie Pierce, played by Robert Silverman. We have the Sheriff, played by Vlastav Reyna. We have, of course, our villain of the episode, and he is the villain of this episode, Michael Rhodes. Robert Silverman was he was in Jason X, the 8th, 9th, 10th Friday the 13th movie. He was also in Scanners and Waterworld.
He was also on a previous episode of Friday the 13th. Our episode called Faith Healer.
Oh, right. Definitely.
So he was the conspiracy theory debunker, the Faith Healer debunker. That was his friend.
The Sheriff has been in various bit parts here and there. Nothing I have ever seen. He's been in a couple of the Assassin's Creed video games as a voiceover. And our villain, Michael Rhodes, was in Hollywoodland and Devil, Police Academy 4, and currently appears on in the 12 Monkeys TV series.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I think the Sheriff is also going to be in our last episode, The Charnel Pit.
Oh.
Friday the 13th. Yeah, there's a few actors on these two episodes that are both going to be on the episodes that we're reviewing today, and then on the last episode, The Charnel Pit.
Yeah, there's a lot of characters in this episode, too, so we don't have time to really go through all of them. But the only other one I wanted to mention was the guy who plays the father, Martin Doyle, has been in Clan of the Cave Bear, The Perfect Man of the Year. And by the way, if you want to see one of the best political satire movies ever made, it was made by, of course, the late, great Robin Williams. And I'm not talking about Good Morning Vietnam. I'm talking about Man of the Year, where he plays like a Stephen Colbert kind of talk show host that runs for president of the United States.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
The best scene in that movie is during the debate, where he just tears apart the two candidates, the guy, the current sitting president, and the guy trying to run against him.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Such a great movie. So, we have some serious racist stuff right from the beginning with the candy bar incident. And, of course, this kid gets gunned down, as we happen to mention. They also, I want to get right out of the way, they happen to say that the brother is retarded, which is a word they're not going to ever use in television these days unless it's in derogatory means. They will also never use nowadays, I don't even know if I can say it, but it's not the N-word, but it's the other version.
Yeah, the word colored.
Well, no, the other one. you know, like Quentin Tarantino, how many times does he say the N-word
in Django?
Yeah.
I mean, it's everywhere. But again, you have to think of historical context.
Right.
And so since that Tarantino piece was a historical period piece, using that language and to try to portray the terribleness of the situation, I think it actually worked. How the words are actually used in this episode work to portray the
Mr. Zeneca, that's not what I'm talking about. What about when we're saying it to talk about what's in the episode itself? Or if, let's say, we did a review of Django Unchained, would we be able to say it?
We'd probably only say it like once or twice.
Okay. So just so everyone's clear, we're saying it because it's said in the movie, not because we're actually saying it in our own lives.
No.
Okay.
No.
Some people do have problems, even if you do say it in the context of like talking about a review, you know what I mean? And they will write in articles the N-word, you know what I mean? They will write like, you know, whatever the equivalent is for other races, you know, and I'm not going to go into it because it's going to go into a diatribe. But, you know, they also say boy. They call, you know, they call the black characters boy, you know, and I don't mean the boy who gets shot. I mean later on.
It was derogatory, yes. It's a derogatory version of saying it.
Yeah. I'm reminded of an episode of Quantum Leap. Sam travels back in time and is in a KKK whole thing. I mean, he's getting hooded. He's getting like inducted into the KKK when he jumps, and he's all like, you know, they're all like, "Woo, yeah, he's a good old boy now. Woo, he's one of us. Yeah." They're all celebrating with him or whatever, and he's like flipping out with Al or whatever, because it's like everything he was ever brought up to be against. And you know, as Al's like, "You've got to calm down because you're gonna play this part and you've got to be a racist." So, and he's just like disgusted with himself over it.
Yeah.
At the end of the episode, he actually takes the noose with the black man who's going to be hung to prove a point, and to his son, or the guy he's leapt into, his son. And in the end, his father-in-law cuts him down with the black man and kind of changes like the course of history because of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But it's a really powerful episode. It's a great, powerful episode, and this absolutely reminds me of it. I do want to say that I love how they go from color to black and white when we go to the past.
Yeah, that seems to be their go-to effect. this is actually the third of our four time travel Friday the 13th episodes.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we had The Baron's Bride, which was another vampire one.
The first vampire one.
Yeah. And then there was the Eye of Death, you know, the lantern that went to the Civil War. And this one, and then the last episode, the Charnel Pit, that's going to be another time travel episode. Episode 72.
Yeah, they, the crew comes back too. Okay, so...
I do have a lot of information on the KKK, so...
Give us a short, brief little history of the KKK, then I'll play a famous clip from a certain movie we all actually really do like.
Okay, well, first of all, the KKK is actually formed by combining the Greek word kuklos, meaning circle, and then the Scottish Gaelic word clan, and that was really done for, you know, it sounded good, you know, Ku Klux Klan. Sometimes they're also called the Ku Klux Klan or Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. Such a tongue twister, I can't say that. At the time of the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education, the Ku Klux Klan actually was founded in 1865 as a secret society of Confederate veterans, and then it kind of turned into a paramilitary group. So as the Ku Klux Klan grew in number, in 1871 the Ku Klux Act passed, meaning the government actually passed the law to thwart these terrorist groups such as the KKK. The 1915 Hollywood blockbuster Birth of a Nation completely took over. Like, it was a very popular movie across the United States, and it glorified the KKK. You know, it portrayed, you know, interracial marriage, stuff like that, and totally glorified the KKK in fighting, you know, the black people existing. I don't know. But at that time, the numbers of the KKK grew about to about 5 or 6 million. That was estimates at the time. And in the 1930s, that started actually declining in membership. There was a FBI crackdown after that. And so the Brown versus Board of Education decision really stimulated all of the white supremacists and people that were racist and all of that at the time, so that the numbers grew. So 1930, the numbers dipped and then started growing again in 1954. And the FBI crackdown pretty much went hardcore in the 60s and 70s until 1975, estimate of only about 3,000 people in the KKK. So, in a nutshell, there you go.
This is a little clip from a certain movie starring Tom Hanks that I absolutely love hearing when he describes the KKK.
Civil War hero General Nathan Bedford Forrest. She said we was related to him in some way, and what he did was he started up this club called the Ku Klux Klan. They'd all dress up in their robes and their bed sheets and act like a bunch of ghosts or spooks or something. They'd even put bed sheets on their horses and ride around. And anyway, that's how I got my name, Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump has no idea that he's related to the Ku Klux Klan.
No, no.
Now, you live in Pennsylvania, which is yes. Not really the South, but it's South compared to where I live, which is Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a Klan march?
No, actually, I haven't.
In the 1990s, I went to school in West Virginia. And you know what I saw? More than once? Yeah.
Was it as surreal as I'm imagining it to be?
It was like ghosts walking down the street, and I don't mean the band.
Ah, yeah. Yeah.
So, and apparently and by the way, West Virginia, Southern private school, you damn betcha that there were former military colonels and captains with the Confederate flag in their classroom, or at least in their offices.
Yep.
This was the 1990s, people, not 2018, where we're tearing them all down. So just keep that in mind. I do not know if those are still up probably today. I haven't been back to that private school in many, 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 many years. I would love to know how much that private school's changed with, like, all the stuff that I look back now and go, wow, that was really racist, or wow, never get away with that today. You know, that sort of thing. So, but the school, by the way, I'm going to point out, the school was very open-minded. They had white, black, you know, Asian students, you know, so on and so forth. They were not, it was not like, oh, you couldn't come to our school. It was a private school. You paid to go there. They accept everybody mm-hmm. with money. Or you were court appointed to go there too, by the way. We had some court appointed people. So I've been exposed to this type of stuff before. I mean, I don't obviously have the level, neither do you, the level of problems with racism as a lot of people do, but I have seen it firsthand having gone to school in Virginia for a number of years.
Oh man, yeah. I grew up in California, so everything was pretty much well diverse where I lived. You know, Southern California has, you know, people from everywhere.
I got a question. How many times do you think Jack, even Ryan, Johnny, and Mickey's name show up on police reports that some cop has to put two and two together to go, you know, I'm going through some old files, and you know whose name keeps showing up on these reports? Jack, Mickey, Ryan, Johnny, last name, whatever.
Ventura, yeah.
Yeah, Jack Marchand's name shows up on a lot of police reports. Why hasn't somebody done something about it? Do you think it's, again, because of Johnny? No, because we didn't really meet Johnny until the end of season two, so...
You do notice that they do kind of, the crew just kind of leaves the scene of a crime, even if they put their grubby hands on things.
This would this show would be so police procedural if done today, you know what I mean? Or one of the characters would be a cop or something, or a detective, or retired police officer, or have, like, help with the police in every episode to fix these problems. I mean, you could say Johnny, like we did last week, has connections with the police force, but I guarantee he's not going to the police force greasing the hands to get the the evidence to go away about curious goods because the cops wouldn't understand the supernatural.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We do see Johnny, hotwire a car in this episode.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Mr. Seneca, what, I'm trying to think. What particular movie has something to do with a car that time travels? I can't think of anything. Maybe this... Back to the Future was immediately what I thought of, despite the fact that we are dealing with some heavy, hot topic, really bad stuff in this episode. I can't help not think of a car that time travels, and yes, it's because of the radio, but what's the flux capacitor, really? No bigger than a car radio in that movie. So yep. It's a car that time travels, it's a radio that time travels, but it's the radio needs the car in order to do it. You can't help but think about Back to the Future watching this episode.
Yeah, there's a lot, actually, in this episode. I mean, I love this episode. Absolutely love this episode. They did not glorify the KKK and it totally made racism abhorrent. Even the whip technique that the guy used on the sharecropper, the technique of the person wielding the whip was actually pretty accurate.
What's funny is that if they made Back to the Future today, let's just face it, a remake is forthcoming at some point in the future. They would time travel to the 1980s, but I guarantee they would still never touch upon, hot political issues. In Back to the Future Part 1, there is that one scene where the future mayor of Hill Valley, who is a black man, says, I am going to clean up this town one day, Mr. Carruthers, or whatever his boss's name is. He goes, that's right, a black mayor. Har, 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 har. Well, you can get there. Yeah. You can start by cleaning this floor. And that's it. It's the only part of, racism that they touch upon in the Back to the Future movies.
Yeah,
he makes a joke that there will never be a black...
Kind of fun.
Yeah, it's poking fun at it. It's in a lighthearted way. The movie's obviously rated PG for a reason, or PG-13. So they make a joke about racism being there'll never be a black mayor. I guarantee that joke today would be, there would never be a black president.
I think I've heard that joke told a few times somewhere.
What, that there would never be a black president?
Yeah.
Did you ever see, by the way, the chart of the presidents of the United States going through George Washington to Donald Trump?
Are they just white, black, orange?
Well, I've seen that one. But they're foods. It's crackers and Oreo, because Obama wasn't pure black. He was black and white. Geez. And then Donald Trump's is a nut. I love that image. I love that image. Every president's number, crackers, Oreo, nut.
Terrible.
I know, it's terrible, but it's still making fun of political stuff, and that's totally fine as long as we're not getting serious about it. So, we really, the overall, topic of this episode, and we kind of, glazed over a lot of little plot points, but we wanted to make it, very, bring out the hard-hittingness of this episode, being as horrible as it is. That poor mother, by the way, loses both of her sons. She loses her mentally challenged son, and she loses her racist son. And she's left kind of alone. I kind of feel bad for her.
A very odd ending.
I really do feel bad for her.
The Curious Goods crew gets back together. Everything's happy for them. And then the camera goes over to the mother. And she's just heartbroken and crying. And then just kind of cuts.
Right.
It's almost like a gut punch. This woman who... is realizing that she's not going to have her children, even though no one expressly told her that her racist son has died. She knows it. She's grieving.
Yeah. I mean, she also knows that her son, she would lose her son anyway, because if that state had the death penalty, he'd go to jail for gunning down that kid.
Gunning down the kid and killing his brother, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God. I mean, it's just horrible. I mean, they really, hit it, hard with this episode, and, It's more impactful because of how socially relevant it is today. Well, I mean, I don't know. We haven't had an abortion episode on Friday the 13th. I don't think we have one coming up either. So
no, I don't think so. No.
And abortion obviously is a pretty big hot topic right now. So, but this couldn't be more socially relevant to today, what is happening today, than anything else. And yes, I understand that I was stretching it a bit with the Jack Marchion Nazi episode, but I was talking about one particular political thing. In this, it's so hard hitting. It's kind of scary.
Yeah, yeah. The character's family name, Pierce.
Yep.
You know, I was in my research. I came across perhaps an inspiration for that name. There was a Walter Pierce, actually died in 1954 at the age of 91 years old. Mm-hmm. So he was born 1861 to 1954. He was the Oregon governor in 1922 that had active support for the KKK.
Wow.
He was liberal on gender and class issues, but he totally was against anyone that was of any color different than himself. So he supported the Japanese internment camps. He was backed by the KKK, and he had 10 years in the House of Representatives. And, you know, Walter Pierce, maybe that was how they came up with the last name for this family, you know, this racist, you know, family. I don't know if the mother didn't really seem racist, and the mentally challenged brother certainly wasn't racist because the little boy Elliot was his friend, and he was very upset when his older brother Ray gunned down his friend Elliot.
Right. How many people die in this episode?
In this episode, we have a total of 3 people dead.
All right. Two. One who should have been killed, one and two who shouldn't have been killed, many more. Wait, what about the clan members? Didn't Johnny get in some good shots and kill some clan members?
No, none of them were actually killed.
I thought he shot a couple of them.
No, from what I saw, it was that he was shooting warning shots.
Oh, right, because if he probably killed anybody, he would alter history. Who knows what those people would have done for the course of history, good or bad.
Yeah, yeah, and so... The real kind of poetic justice of this episode is that the racist son gets killed by his own father, tied to the stake, pretty much, because they think that he's an FBI informant that's giving the FBI information on the KKK's, you know, happenings. And that's, I don't know, I felt pleasure in that, actually. The racist getting killed by his racist dad. And we realize that the person that sent the dad to the hangman's noose was actually his mom. And, yeah, there's a lot going on in this episode. If you really haven't seen it, of course, all these spoilers, but I definitely say that you should watch it. In today's political climate, I mean, this is a great episode to watch because it portrays racism in such a way.
Definitely. Well, we're going to take a little bit of a break and play the promo for the next episode here on the Dead TV Podcast for Friday the 13th, Episode 8.
Where the hell are you? Coming up on the next Friday the 13th, the series.
What are you talking about?
An age-old terror makes its mark again.
What?
For centuries, they've ruled the night.
To let me go with him, I'll die.
No, you won't.
But now... A special cross could end the legacy of the Prince of Darkness.
Cross of Fire.
Vampires beware of the next Friday the 13th, the series.
And we're back with the next episode of Friday the 13th, the series, which is our second, like, vampire episode, which is kind of cool.
Vampire.
And it's actually vampires, too. They're real in this universe, which is kind of interesting, because they weren't real last time, were they?
Well, the time travel episode, Baron's Bride, like he was turned into the vampire before he got the brooch on him.
But I think
they were real.
Okay, they were real. Maybe I'm thinking of the werewolf episode. The werewolf episode, they were not real.
No, the werewolf episode, he got turned into the werewolf by the cursed object.
Right, okay. So the vampire
werewolfism
episode...
Werewolfism didn't exist.
So we've already established vampires exist in this universe, and in this they happen to be in the present, and they're really, like, active, too, which is, you know, which made the episode really crazy.
Yeah, and it's such a used over and over trope is the nightclub that is run by vampires. What, and where did we see that before? In Kindred the Embraced.
The very first episode, the very first TV series we covered here on the show.
That is true.
There is some serious, like, hardcore vampire stuff going on in this episode. We got people being bitten. We got people being staked. We got people being burned. We got lesbian vampires. We've got, like, it is, like,
oh,
hard.
My God. And the death count of this episode is greater than any of the other episodes of the Friday the 13th, the series we've seen. 10.
Yeah, it's crazy. 10 deaths. How, like, the vampires in this episode are. I mean, hell, even in the book by Elise Wax, there is, like, serious detail. Like, there's a photo saying, like, oh, they're getting ready for the lesbian vampire scene. And there's, like, two of those scenes in this episode. Now, granted, when a vampire bites somebody, they're just looking for blood. But the way they shoot it in the cinematography, and I know I'm getting a little too far ahead, but the cinematography, like, with that one scene where the character gives the victim to the female vampire, and then early on we see the female vampire with their victim in bed, groping and kissing and biting. I mean, that's pretty erotic for this show for this time period.
Oh my God, it's steamy.
It's very sexy. Steamy. It is so hot in this episode. I was like, wow. This episode is smoking.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, did you recognize the music played in the beginning of the episode and also towards the end of the episode, basically at the second lesbian vampire scene? Did you recognize that music? Because I did.
No, what is it from?
It is from the movie The Hunger. It's the same piece of music. I mean, it's a classical orchestration, but it's the same piece of music that they play in the beginning of the film that's after the main nightclub stalking and grabbing of the prey. The two vampires, Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie, are in the shower, and this music is playing in the background, and it's supposed to illustrate kind of this romantic a vampire love, and so when the two human characters in the very beginning, before we get to the credits, two human characters are in this kind of romantic dinner, and they are holding hands and talking about their be together forever, and in the shower, in The Hunger, they're talking about being together forever, and with the same music. And The Hunger came out in 1983, so I believe that was inspired as the inspiration for this particular episode.
Wow, I did not catch that whatsoever. That's awesome. I mean, that yeah, man, I have not seen that in such a long time.
Yeah, it's a classical orchestration, and it's, I believe, meant to portray the feeling of romance in this kind of horror genre. So, yeah, I immediately picked it up. But in this episode, we're actually talking about, it opens up kind of interesting with a voiceover from Jack, and being how he doesn't know what's evil or good anymore.
Yeah, that was really weird. And in Elise's book, she references suicidal tendencies.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, in this episode, there was a lot of very, very beautiful skies and sunsets. Very beautiful sunsets. So Jack is kind of sitting at this bench and talking in this depressive state. And then by the end of the episode, when he doesn't kill the vampire, I'm like, dude, I don't think you've got anything to whine about. There was a clear difference here between good and evil. Evil would be the vampires, because they're killing people daily. Yeah, kill the vampire. What's the argument there? I don't see any good that he would be arguing with himself about. It just kind of bugged me.
Yeah, a little.
In my notes, I wrote coward.
A lot of romance in this episode. One thing I wanted to point out, the special effects in this are okay, especially like when the vampires die. Very grotesque. A lot of special effects used for that. The cross reminds me of if you've ever played the video game Castlevania, you are a vampire hunter who walks his way through Dracula's castle, fighting a bunch of monsters until you fight Count Dracula, and then you kill him. There's an anime show on Netflix right now for 2 seasons. Highly recommend checking it out, because Richard Artemich, Thorin Oakenshield from The Hobbit, he plays the lead good guy, Trevor Belmont.
Oh,
excellent
cool.
voice acting. It's anime, but it's beautiful, and it's gothic. It's bloody. It's violent. It's definitely for adults. Warren Ellis, famed comic book writer Warren Ellis, is the showrunner of the show. If you look at what he's done, then you understand why the show is very adult. But this is very like something in that, where you would use the cross as a weapon, and light and fire would shoot out of it. Like, nothing I can think of off the top of my head has there ever been a cross used to do that. However, in an issue of X-Men... Dracula bites Storm, and Storm starts slowly turning into a vampire. And in it, Wolverine tries to use his claws to repel Dracula. Dracula's like, you idiot, that doesn't work against somebody who doesn't believe in it. And Nightcrawler, who looks like a demon, picks up Kitty's stakes and forms a cross with him and says, it's a good thing then I do believe. And Dracula's like, this light shines out of the cross onto Dracula. And Dracula's like, ah, how can a foul creature such as yourself believe in God after it's rejected you with your appearance? And Nightcrawler's response is, God loves all of its children, no matter what they look like. And he continues repelling Dracula back with the cross because he's such a devoted Catholic.
Oh, I love Nightcrawler.
It
love
is
him.
My favorite scene in any comic book involving fighting a vampire. And I swear it's one of the reasons why the X-Men movies are so terrible, because they don't put that level of care into the movies like Chris Claremont did with that one panel where Nightcrawler, a demon, propels Dracula with the cross. And Dracula's just like not expecting, you know, Nightcrawler to have such faith in his religion despite his appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so good. By the way, that issue is the inspiration that gave Joss Whedon to create Buffy the Vampire Slayer one day, because Kitty Pryde, she like cowboys up in a Indiana Jones looking costume with stakes and a fedora and a brown trench coat and a satchel to go after Storm to free her from Dracula.
Ooh, wow.
And she's a teenage girl. And she's also a Jew, by the way, because when Dracula grabs her by the throat, he burns his hand on her Star of David.
Ah, nice. I did not know that.
He's like, the accursed symbol of the Jews. Ah!
Well, I mean, this is a little off topic, but it's related to one of the shows that we saw. You know, my favorite vampire scene in a comic book is from Constantine, or a Hellblazer, and it's the character Constantine. After he had this time where he's basically a bum for a couple years, he's kind of depressive and all that, he gets involved, or, you know, tangibly involved, with a vampire group because they are looking to kill him, and the main vampire ends up biting Constantine, but because Constantine has demon blood in his system, it actually kills this king vampire. And it's hilarious and gruesome at the same time. The flesh starts bubbling off, and then the sunlight comes up from dawn, and Constantine is there just laughing. Yeah, like laughing that he wanted to seek out death. Death found him, and he still couldn't die.
Speaking of Constantine, highly recommend checking out this week's episode of DC's Legends of Tomorrow. The legends land in the 1990s at a summer camp as they're worried that a swamp-like creature is eating children. And yes, they do reference Swamp Thing, but John says, I know a Swamp Thing, love, and he's a little further up north than where we're going. And I'm like, I'm so happy. They don't have to have him in the episode, probably due to the fact he's going to get his own TV show, so the copyright with the character might be somewhere else. But that was so cool that John, they actually stuck that in there. That was as great as in a previous... I totally fanboyed out. That was as great as in this previous week's episode of Arrow. They keep mentioning the demon wants Oliver Queen, and Oliver's in prison right now. It's like, well, obviously it's Ra's al Ghul or someone connected to him, and it's Talia. And Talia says... I ran it, because he's like, how did you get here, Talia? You're like this master assassin and thief. How the hell did you get caught? And he's like, she's like, I ran into an old friend in Gotham City and ended up here. I'm like, so little things like that for characters they can't use are still really great. But John is fantastic on this show. The next episode, I think they need to like save him because he used a lot of his life force to help reinvigorate a kid. It's a weird kind of like witch like vampire that eats like children from another part of the world is basically what's causing the problems. The swamp creature is nothing. It's kids playing pranks, but kids are disappearing. Good episode. You get to see John B. like so John's paired off with Ray Palmer, who's like the let's go on nature walks and let me show you how to tie a knot. And John's like the badass kind of counselor who smokes and talks to the British accent. You know what I mean? He's not Ray Palmer, who's all squeaky clean, let's just say. So he's not exactly teaching the kids the good things. No, but he works great on this show with other DC characters. Highly recommend checking it out if you watched and listened to our coverage of Constantine.
Now, the idea that crosses can actually harm vampires, that was kind of something that appeared in 1871 to 1872 in the serial from The Dark Blue called Carmilla. And so she actually does have some sort of repelled by religious artifacts. But for the most part, a lot of people attribute that particular vampiric weakness to Dracula from Bram Stoker, 1897.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but Carmilla actually predates Dracula by 26 years, so.
Oh.
I mean, it's another lesbian vampire story, so.
Oh,
I'm
very familiar with Carmilla. Huh? The aforementioned Castlevania, Carmilla is Dracula's, first lieutenant on that show, until she betrays him. And there's a YouTube series, by the way, set in modern days, made by lesbian producers and directors, a modern-day Carmilla story. And it's not, super sexualized, sexy. They're wearing normal clothes, and she just happens to be Carmilla the Vampire in present-day 20-whatever.
Okay.
It's a YouTube series. We're checking out. I've talked to the director. She's, we've talked back and forth about coming on the show, just a matter of, kind of when and, so.
Mm-hmm. In this episode, they're saying that the cursed object is the Cross of Fire. And, just for larks, I looked up to see if there's an actual Hungarian cross of fire, and it turns out that they do honor a military award called the Fire Cross, and so the Fire Cross in Hungarian is Tutskereszt. That's Tutskereszt.
Neat.
Tutskereszt. Cool. Yeah. Yeah, so not anything real, with the knife in the cross, but
do you think it's unusual the crew let the vampire wife live and go? I mean, it's
God.
A little responsibility for your action there, guys.
I was watching this and I thought that Kurt, the vampire hunter, believed that if he were to kill the vampire that turned his wife, that his wife would turn back to normal, because he said the words set me free.
No, you know why? She's already dined on some nice female flesh.
Well, yeah, I mean that's 20 years ago.
But still, I mean, you bite somebody, you drink their blood, you kill somebody. That's it. Curses intact. No go backs. You're done.
Some vampire media says that if you kill the main vampire, all the other ones will, come back to life.
I don't know. All right. By the way, so there's a great movie worth checking out that kind of follows the same type of thinking called Boy Eats Girl. In it, it opens up with an archaeologist discovering the cure for zombieism, and flash forward to Ireland where the movie was shot, because it's an Irish horror movie. And her son is bitten by a zombie, and there's a zombie outbreak in Ireland. And it's up to him and his best friends to help keep him alive, and he has to stave off biting somebody because he gets a message from his mom to, to don't eat flesh or whatever, I got the cure. And basically, it's rattlesnake venom.
Rattlesnake venom is a cure?
Being bitten by a rattlesnake in the bite mark of the zombie will cure you as long as you have not consumed flesh.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's actually a really good kind of little horror movie, because I was like, that's also the first horror movie I've ever heard of that actually had a cure for being a zombie. Most horror movies, you're dead, done, that's it, no more.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
I can't think of a horror movie where zombies were reversed, unless it was like a cartoon or, again, something I can't think of off the top of my head. But most of the time, you become a zombie. That's it. It's over. Vampires, yeah. I've seen it. I mean, what's the Catherine Bigelow vampire movie starring Lance Henriksen?
I don't know.
Are you kidding me?
You know, man, you're the guy that does IMDb stuff. I can't remember stars' names.
By the way, the vampire woman in this episode was Jill Hennessy, who we've talked about before. She was on Crossing Jordan.
Yes.
Yes, she plays a very sexy vampire.
And she will also be in the Charnel Pit.
Until Dark. This is the vampire movie by Catherine Bigelow.
Until Dark.
Yes. It's about a guy who falls in love with a girl, and she's like part of a vampire clan. If you look at the cast, it's also like Bill Paxton. It's the big, really tough Hispanic chick from Aliens and Terminator 2. Mm-hmm. Kind of curious why all these Cameron people were in this movie. It's because Cameron was married to Bigelow at the time that she was making this movie.
Ah.
Yeah, so there are five people in this movie that have been in Terminator and Aliens and Titanic and so on and so forth. They're all James Cameron's kind of cast of extras.
Cool.
Yeah. But anyway, the point is, at the end of the movie, our main character, Bill Paxton, and the hot vampire girl he fell in love with turned back into humans.
Yeah, so I thought that's what was happening with this one. But when both the main vampire and her new vampire hunter turned vampire mate are dead, and Jack doesn't finish the job by killing the last vampire in the room, I was like, "Oh, Howard, you need to do it! Finish the goddamn job!"
The hooker the wife dines on has been typecasted as playing, like, girl at bar, hot nurse.
Aww.
Yeah, no, but hey, she's got a long IMDb career. She's been in tons of stuff. She was on Hercules for a number of years too, 9 episodes. So she's got a long career playing a hot girl. And by the way, Friday the 13th was her first role as the hooker.
Interesting. Okay, cool.
Yeah, that launched her career, and she's still acting as of today.
Oh. In this movie, or in this episode, we see the trope of vampires don't have a reflection.
Holy water.
The holy water melts them. And then, of course, the nightclub owner being a vampire.
Hold on a second. Okay, so in a lot of times, holy water being thrown on a vampire is not going to just kill them. It's going to hurt them. It's going to damage them badly. They are susceptible to other attacks.
Yes.
If you immerse a vampire completely in holy water, a la, like, the Lost Boys, you remember? Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, they're going to get killed. So it was kind of unusual to see the holy water thrown on the vampire hunter by Jack, and he just dies. And I was like, wow, that didn't take much. At least use the cross, man. You have the cross. Use the cross. But I guess here's the other thing. How many times has the cursed antique been used for good?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of those antiques that you have to take from one person and it gives to another. Like the Shaman's Rattle was one of them recently. A lot of objects like the scalpel. The scalpel was one of them where you had to kill someone in order to heal someone else. So you could say that there is good there. You just have to do bad to commit it.
excuse me.
Vampire mythology, though, holy water really wasn't a big thing. The big thing was like the Eucharist, the body of Christ. So,
the communion wafers, you mean?
Eucharist, okay. Eucharist.
Okay.
Corpses were buried with the Eucharist in their mouth to prevent vampirism.
What about I forgot where I was going with this. We do get a staking, too, which was kind of like, wow, they went there.
Yeah, stake the vampire.
That was
stake the hot vampire.
That was Jill Hennessy from Crossing Jordan. I'm like, she needs to play more vampires. she needs to play more vampires.
Yeah.
There are certain female actors in Hollywood I would love to see play a vampire. How much would you love to see Scarlett Johansson play a vampire?
Ooh.
Very sexy, right? Yeah. What about Jennifer Garner?
You know, I see her more as a vampire hunter.
No, I would like to see Jennifer Garner as like an older vampire because she's now getting those older character roles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's in her 40s, so she's, you know what I mean? She's not. I would, if they made a Camilla movie, say a Hollywood actually made a Camilla movie, who should they cast as Camilla?
Well, it'd have to be someone that looks good as a blonde because Carmilla was a blonde.
I'm really concerned about the hair color sometimes because Hollywood will change what they're going to change. But just
like the Constantine movie, you don't make Constantine with black hair.
I think Charlize Theron would play Carmilla perfectly. She has the features, her facial structure, her eyes.
Yeah.
I think she would make an amazing Carmilla. And she has no problem with, you know, sexual content on screen, especially in terms of bisexuality or lesbians, because of if you saw Platinum Blonde.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, she or Monster, even, you know, you want to go into Monster, but that doesn't look like, you know, the whole point of that movie was she was not going to look like Charlize Theron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need that one type of woman who's comfortable with that type of sexuality and those type of scenes. And who could look as good and beautiful as Carmilla, because Carmilla was very beautiful, right?
Yes, okay. She was supposedly extremely beautiful, and her desires for the other members of the household that she was brought into was basically what was leading them to their deaths.
I'm just shocked they have never made one before, they haven't made one, let's say, in the last 20, 30 years, you know, in theaters, big budget. Starring, directed by, you know what I mean?
Carmilla also could walk in the sunlight.
Yeah, because she's not a real vampire. I mean, she's not like the way we think about vampires in this episode.
No, because it was one of the first ones in media, so a lot of the traits that we associate with vampires now weren't associated with her.
We have talked about this before, because we have covered vampires, and we will be covering vampires in a big way again as we go to the King of the Vampires, Count Dracula, coming up after the end of Friday the 13th. For 5 weeks before we do the Addams Family, I am looking forward to John Rhys Meyers' portrayal of the famous Count. I thought he did it very well, and I think that show got canceled prematurely. Thankfully, if we didn't have that show canceled, we would have gotten Constantine, but then Constantine was also canceled. Mr. Zeneca, have you ever encountered anybody who has said that they are a vampire?
Yes.
And?
Okay.
Hold on, I'm going to pair myself some wine and light some candles, because this story might get hot.
You certainly could.
Oh, my. Where are we going with this story?
Okay, well, now I've known vampires from, goth clubs or whatnot that actually say that they are a vampire or they drink, you know, blood or whatnot. Now, on the Sci-Fi Channel, there was a television show called Mad Mad House. And Mad Mad House had a group of five lifestyle alternative people, and one of them was a vampire. So the person that was on this reality television show as the vampire character, Don Henry. Don Henry and I had a photo shoot with Sub Miss Anne in the Joshua Tree Desert, and it was a bloodbath, you know, pretty much. Like, so I have photos with this Don Henry, the vampire. He claims and believes he's a vampire, and he gets a lot of press for it. And it was a very fun photo shoot. I loved it, you know.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah, that's a little tidbit from my modeling days.
Good to know. Awesome. Well, that's all the time we have here for the Dead TV podcast. How many people died in this episode?
In this episode, we've got 10 people that died.
Two of which came back as vampires, or three.
Yeah. And from our previous episode...
You said three.
There's no way that I could own a 1954 car.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it wasn't the car, it was the radio.
It was a radio, but yeah, that goes in the car.
And I do own a crucifix. It actually is hanging on my wall right now, right mm-hmm. next to my Universal Church of Life inductee to be a minister. And the cross,
or you're ordained.
Yes, and if you've been on the Radio of Horror Facebook page for a number of months, almost a year, I think, the main picture was a cross, but if you saw the bottom of the cross, was sharpened into a stake. I picked that up for $5 at a convention. I don't know if you could sell those at conventions today. I bought that about 6 years ago. Things have changed at conventions due to mass shootings and other problems in society. Yeah. But, a guy was wheedling away these wooden crosses, and the bottom of them were sharpened to a point.
Cool.
Very cool. And they were $5. Who could pass that up? Hangs perfectly in my wall. It's a great conversation starter when you bring a date over. It's like, what is that? Well, that's just in case you reveal your true colors. I wonder why none of the dates come back then. That is all the time we have here tonight for the Dead TV Podcast. You can check us out on the Dead TV Podcast Facebook page. You can also join us on our individual Twitters at ChrisDSAV.
At Elegantly Kinky.
Don't forget, you can also join us on Patreon. There's a Patreon, Dr. Chris's Radio of Horror. We'd like to thank all of our sustaining Patreon members. And if you are a business or a website or some type of thing that you would like to get sponsorship on the Radio of Horror Network, there are 3 podcasts and a radio show that you can join. Send an email to thatradiohorror@gmail.com. And for the time that this is going to be posted online, we'd like to say Happy Thanksgiving to everybody, as this is the day after Thanksgiving that you'll be listening to this on Black Friday. Yeah. So, anyway, thank you for tuning in to the Dead TV Podcast.
Good night.